As the camera panned to Celia, I swear I sobered up and clasped my hands together as tightly as possible for her, as if the harder I pressed them together, the higher her chances of winning. And the award goes to Celia St. James for Little Women. I jumped up out of my seat and shouted for her, and then my eyes got teary as she walked up to the stage. As she stood there behind the microphone, holding the statuette, I was mesmerized by her fabulous boat-neck dress, her sparkling diamond and sapphire earrings, and that absolutely flawless face of hers. Thank you to Ari Sullivan and Harry Cameron. Thank you to my agent, Roger Colton, to my family, and to the amazing cast of women that I felt so lucky to be a part of, to Joy and Ruby, and to Evelyn Hugo. Thank you. When she said my name, I swelled with pride and joy and love. I was so goddamn happy for her. And then I did something mortifyingly inane. I kissed the television set. I kissed her, right on her grayscale face. The clink I heard registered before the pain, and as Celia waved to the crowd and then stepped away from the podium, I realized I chipped my tooth. But I didn't care. I was too happy, too excited to congratulate her and tell her how proud I was. I made another cocktail and forced myself to watch the rest of the spectacle. They announced Best Picture, and as the credits rolled, I turned off the TV. I knew that Harry and Celia would be out all night, so I shut off the lights and went upstairs to bed. I took off my makeup, I put on cold cream, I turned down the covers. I was lonely, living all alone. Celia and I had discussed it and came to the conclusion that we could not move in together. She was less convinced of this than I was, but I was steadfast in my resolve. Even though my career was in the gutter, hers was thriving. I couldn't let her risk it, not for me. My head was on the pillow, but my eyes were wide open when I heard someone pull into the driveway. I looked out the window to see Celia slipping out of a car and waving goodnight to her driver. She had an Oscar in her hand. "You look comfortable," Celia said once she'd made her way to me in the bedroom. "Come here," I said to her. She'd had a glass or three. I loved her drunk. She was herself but happier, so bubbly I sometimes worried she'd float away. She took a running start and hopped into the bed. I kissed her. "I'm so proud of you, darling." "I missed you all night," she said. The Oscar was still in her hand, and I could tell it was heavy. She kept allowing it to tip over onto the mattress. The space for her name was blank. "I don't know if I was supposed to take this one," she said, smiling, "but I didn't want to give it back." "Why aren't you out celebrating? You should be at the sunset party." "I only wanted to celebrate with you." I pulled her closer to me. She kicked off her shoes. "Nothing means anything without you," she said. "Everything that isn't you is a pile of dog shit." I tossed my head back and laughed. "What happened to your tooth?" Celia asked. "Is it that noticeable?" Celia shrugged. "I suppose not. I think it's just that I've memorized every inch of you." Just a few weeks ago, I had lain naked beside Celia and let her look at me, look at every part of my body. She had told me she wanted to remember every detail. She said it was like studying a Picasso. "It's embarrassing," I told her now. Celia sat up, intrigued. "I kissed the television screen," I said. "When you won, I kissed you on the TV, and I chipped my tooth." Celia laughed so hard she cackled. The statuette fell back to the mattress with a thump, and then she rolled over on top of me and put her arms around my neck. "That's the most lovable thing anyone has ever done since the dawn of man." I suppose I'll make a dentist appointment first thing tomorrow. I suppose you will. I picked up her Oscar. I stared at it. I wanted one myself. And if I had stuck it out with Don a little longer, I could have had one tonight. She was still in her dress, her heels long gone. Her hair was falling out of the pins. Her lipstick was faded. Her earrings still glistened. "Have you ever made love to an Oscar winner?" she said. I'd done something very close with Ari Sullivan, but I didn't think that was the time to tell her. And anyway, the spirit of the question was if I'd ever experienced a moment like that one. And I absolutely had not. I kissed her and felt her hands on my face, and then I watched as she stepped out of her dress and into my bed. Both of my movies flopped. A Romance Celia Did sold out theaters. Don starred in a hit thriller movie. Ruby Riley's reviews for Joker's Wild called her stunningly perfect and positively incomparable. I taught myself how to make meatloaf and iron my own slacks. And then I saw Breathless. I left the theater, went straight home, called Harry Cameron and said, "I have an idea. I'm going to Paris." Celia was shooting a movie on location in Big Bear for 3 weeks. I knew that going with her wasn't an option, nor was visiting her on the set. She insisted she would come home every weekend, but it felt too risky. She was a single girl, after all. I was afraid the prevailing wisdom erred too close to the question, what do single girls have to go home to? So I decided it was the right time to go to France. Harry had some connections to filmmakers in Paris. He made a few calls on the sly for me. Some of the producers and directors I met with knew who I was. Some of them were clearly seeing me just as a favor to Harry. And then there was Max Girard, an up-and-coming New Wave director who had never heard of me before. "You are une bombe," he said. We were sitting in a quiet bar in the Saint-Germain-des-Prés neighborhood of Paris. We huddled in a booth in the back. It was just after dinner time, and I hadn't had a chance to eat. Max was drinking a white Bordeaux. I had a glass of claret. "That sounds like a compliment," I said, taking a sip. "I don't know if I have before met a woman so attractive," he said, staring at me. His accent was so thick that I found myself leaning in to hear him. "Thank you." "You can act," he said. "Better than I look." "That cannot be so." "It is." I saw Max's wheels start turning. "Are you willing to test for a part?" I was willing to scrub a toilet for a part. "If the part is great," I said. Max smiled. "This part is spectacular. This part is a movie star part." I nodded slowly. "You have to restrain every part of your body when you are working hard not to look eager." "Send me the pages and we'll talk," I said, and then I drank the last of my wine and stood up. "I'm so sorry, Max, but I should go. Have a wonderful evening. Let's be in touch." There was absolutely no way I was going to sit at a bar with a man who hadn't heard of me and let him think I had all the time in the world. I could feel his eyes on me as I walked away, but I walked out the door with all the confidence I had, which, despite my current predicament, was quite a lot. And then I went back to my hotel room, put on my pajamas, ordered room service, and turned on the TV. Before I went to bed, I wrote Celia a letter. "My dearest Cece, please never forget that the sun rises and sets with your smile. At least to me it does. You're the only thing on this planet worth worshipping. All my love, Edward." I folded it in half and tucked it into an envelope addressed to her. Then I turned out my light and closed my eyes. 3 hours later, I was awakened by the jarring sound of a phone ringing on the table next to me. I picked it up, irritated and half asleep. "Bonjour," I said. "We can speak your language, Evelyn." Max's accented English reverberated through the phone. "I am calling to see if you would be free to be in a movie I am shooting the week after next."
2 weeks from now?
Not even quite. We are shooting 6 hours from Paris. You will do it?
What is the part? How long is the shoot?
The movie is called Bout en Train. At least that's what it is called for now. We shoot for 2 weeks in Lac d'Annecy. The rest of the shoot, you do not need to be there.
What does bout en train mean?
I tried to say it the way he said it, but it came out overprocessed, and I vowed not to try again. Don't do things you're not good at. It means the life of the party. That is you.
A party girl?
Like someone who is the heart of life.
And my character?
She is the kind of woman every man falls in love with. It was originally written for a French woman, but I have just decided tonight that if you will do it, I will fire her.
That's not nice.
She's not you.
I smiled, surprised at both his charm and his eagerness.
It is about two men who are petty thieves, and they are on the run to Switzerland when they are distracted by an incredible woman they meet on the way. The three of them go for an adventure in the mountains. I've been sitting here with my pages, trying to decide if this woman can be American. And I think she can. I think it's more interesting that way. It is a stroke of luck to meet you at this time, so you will do it?
Let me sleep on it, I said. I knew I was going to take the part. It was the only part I could get, but you never get anywhere good by seeming amenable.
Yes, Max said. Of course, you have done nudity before, yes?
No, I said.
I think you should be topless in the film.
If I was going to be asked to show my breasts, wouldn't it be for a French film? And if the French were going to ask anyone, shouldn't it be me? I knew what got me famous the first time. I knew what it could do a second time.
Why don't we discuss it tomorrow? I said. Let's talk tomorrow morning, he said, because this other actress I have, she will show her breasts, Evelyn.
It's late, Max. I'll ring you in the morning. And I hung up the phone. I closed my eyes and breathed in deeply, considering both how beneath me this opportunity was and how lucky I was to be given it. It's a hard business, reconciling what the truth used to be with what the truth is now. Luckily, I didn't have to do it for very long. 2 weeks later, I was back on a film set, and this time I was free of all the buttoned-up, innocent girl stuff that Sunset had pinned on me. This time I was able to do whatever I wanted. It was clear for the entire shoot that Max wanted nothing more than to possess me himself. I could tell by the way he looked at me in stolen glances that part of my allure to Max the director was my allure to him as a man. When Max came to my dressing room on the second-to-last day of filming, he said, "Ma belle, aujourd'hui tu seras seins nus." I had picked up enough French by then to know he was saying he wanted to shoot my scene coming out of the lake. When you're an American movie star with huge boobs in a French movie, you quickly learn that when French men are saying seins nus, they are talking about you being topless. I was fully willing to take my top off and show my assets, if that was what it took to get my name back out there. But by that point, I had fallen madly in love with a woman. I had grown to desire her with every fiber of myself. I knew the pleasure of finding delight in a woman's naked body. So I told Max I'd shoot it however he wanted, but that I had a suggestion that might make the movie even more of a sensation. I knew my idea was a good one, because I knew how it felt to want to tear a woman's shirt off. And when Max heard it, he knew it was a good one, because he knew how it felt to want to tear my shirt off. In the editing room, Max slowed down my exit from the lake to a snail's crawl, and then cut the footage a millisecond before you can see my full breasts. It simply cut to black, as if the film itself had been tampered with, as if maybe you'd just gotten a bad cut. There was so much anticipation, and it never paid off, no matter how many times you watched it, no matter how perfectly you paused the tape. And here's why it worked. Man, woman, gay, straight, bisexual, you name it, we all just want to be teased. 6 months after we finished shooting Bout en Train, I was an international sensation.
Photo Moment, September 15, 1961. Singer Mick Riva, Suite for Evelyn Hugo. Performing last night at the Trocadero, Mick Riva had a few minutes to indulge our questions. Armed with an old-fashioned that appeared not to be his first, Mick was awfully forthcoming. He revealed that he's happy to be divorced from siren Veronica Lowe because, he said, I didn't deserve a lady like that, and she didn't deserve a guy like me. And when asked if he's dating, he admitted he's been seeing quite a few ladies, but that he'd give them all up for one night with Evelyn Hugo. The former Mrs. Dawn Adler has proven to be a very hot commodity these days. Her appearance in French director Max Girard's new film Bout en Train has spent the summer selling out movie houses all over Europe, and now it's taking the good old U.S. of A. by storm. I've seen Bout en Train 3 times now, Mick told us, and I'll see it a fourth. I just can't get enough of her coming out of that lake. So would he like to take Evelyn out on a date? I'd like to marry her is what I'd like to do. You hear that, Evelyn? Hollywood Digest, October 2nd, 1961. Evelyn Hugo to play Anna Karenina. Talk of the town, Evelyn Hugo has just signed on to play the title role in Fox's epic Anna Karenina. She has also signed to produce the picture with Harry Cameron, formerly of Sunset Studios. Miss Hugo and Mr. Cameron worked together at Sunset on such hits as Father and Daughter and Little Women. This will be their first project together outside of the Sunset umbrella. Mr. Cameron, who has made a name for himself in the biz for his great taste and even greater business acumen, is said to have left Sunset over differences with none other than studio head Ari Sullivan. But it appears Fox is eager to be in business with both Miss Hugo and Mr. Cameron, as they have ponied up a substantial fee and a stake in the box office. Everyone has been watching to see what Miss Hugo's next project will be. Anna Karenina is an interesting choice. One thing's for sure, if Evelyn so much as shows a bare shoulder in the flick, audiences will come running. Sub Rosa, October 23rd, 1961. Dawn Adler and Ruby Riley, engaged. Mary and Roger Adler threw a party this past Saturday that was said to have grown a bit out of control. The guests who showed up were surprised to learn that it wasn't just a party for Dawn Adler. It was to announce the engagement of Dawn and none other than Sunset Studios' reigning queen, Ruby Riley. Dawn and Ruby have become close after Dawn's divorce from bombshell Evelyn Hugo almost 2 years ago. Apparently, Dawn admitted he had eyes for Ruby way back when she and Evelyn were shooting Little Women together. We are so happy for Dawn and Ruby, but we can't help but wonder how Dawn feels about Evelyn's skyrocketing fame. She is the hottest thing under the sun right now, and if we had let her go, we'd be kicking ourselves. Regardless, best wishes to Dawn and Ruby. Hopefully, this one sticks.
I was sent an invitation to see Mick Riva perform at the Hollywood Bowl that fall. I decided to go, not because I cared about seeing Mick Riva, but because an evening outside sounded fun. And I wasn't above courting the tabloids. Celia, Harry, and I decided to go together. I would never have gone with just Celia, not with that many eyes on us, but Harry was a perfect buffer. That night, the air in L.A. was cooler than I had anticipated. I was wearing capri pants and a short-sleeved sweater. I had just gotten bangs and had started sweeping them to the side. Celia had on a blue shift dress and flats. Harry, dapper as ever, was wearing slacks and a short-sleeved Oxford shirt. He held a camel-colored knit cardigan with oversized buttons in his hand, ready for any of us who were too cold. We sat in the second row with a couple of Harry's producer friends from Paramount. Across the aisle, I saw Ed Baker with a young woman who appeared as if she could be his daughter, but I knew better. I decided not to say hi, not only because he was still a part of the Sunset Machine, but also because I never liked him. Mick Riva took the stage, and the women in the crowd started cheering so loudly that Celia actually put her hands over her ears. He was wearing a dark suit with a loose tie. His jet-black hair was combed back, but just slightly disheveled. If I had to guess, I'd say he'd had a drink or two backstage, but it didn't seem to slow him down in the slightest. "I don't get it," Celia said to me as she leaned into my ear. "What do they see in this guy?" I shrugged. "That he's handsome, I suppose." Mick walked up to the microphone, the spotlight following him. He grabbed the mic stand with both passion and softness, as if it were one of the many girls yelling his name. "And he knows what he's doing," I said. Celia shrugged. "I'd take Brick Thomas over him any day." I shook my head, cringing. "No. Brick Thomas is a heel, trust me. If you met him, within 5 seconds you'd be gagging." Celia laughed. "I think he's cute." "No, you don't," I said. "Well, I think he's cuter than Mick Riva," she said. "Harry, thoughts?" Harry leaned in from the other side. He whispered so softly I almost didn't hear him. "I'm embarrassed to admit I have something in common with these shrieking girls," he said. "I would not kick Mick out of bed for eating crackers." Celia laughed. "You are too much," I said, as I watched Mick walk from one end of the stage to the other, crooning and smoldering. "Where are we eating after this?" I asked them both. "That's the real question." "Don't we have to go backstage?" Celia asked. "Isn't that the polite thing to do?" Mick's first song ended, and everyone started clapping and cheering. Harry leaned over me as he clapped so Celia could hear him. "You won an Oscar, Celia," he said. "You can do whatever the hell you want." She threw her head back and laughed as she clapped. "Well, then, I want to go get a steak." "Steak it is," I said. I don't know whether it was the laughing or the cheering or the clapping. There was so much noise around me, so much chaos from the crowd. But for one fleeting moment, I forgot myself. I forgot where I was. I forgot who I was. I forgot who I was with. And I grabbed Celia's hand and held it. She looked down, surprised. I could feel Harry's gaze on our hands, too. I pulled my hand away, and just as I corrected myself, I saw a woman down the row from us stare at me. She looked to be in her mid-30s, with a patrician face, small blue eyes, and perfectly applied crimson lipstick. Her lips turned down as she looked at me. She had seen me. She had seen me hold Celia's hand, and she had seen me pull it back. She knew both what I had done and that I had not meant for her to have seen it. Her small eyes got smaller as she stared at me. And any hope I had that she did not realize who I was went right out the window when she turned to the man next to her, probably her husband, and whispered in his ear. I watched as his gaze moved from Mick Riva to me. There was a subtle disgust in his eyes, as if he was unsure if what he suspected was true, but that the thought in his head made him nauseated, and it was my fault for putting it there. I wanted to slap both of them across their faces and tell them that what I did was none of their business. But I knew I couldn't do that. It wasn't safe to do that. I wasn't safe. We weren't safe. Mick hit an instrumental part in the song and started walking toward the very front of the stage, talking to the audience. Reflexively, I stood up and cheered for him. I jumped up and down. I was louder than anyone there. I wasn't thinking clearly. I just wanted to make the two of them stop talking to each other or to anyone else. I wanted the gossip game of telephone that had started with that woman to end with that man. I wanted it all to be over. I wanted to be doing something else. So I cheered as loudly as I could. I cheered like the teenage girls in the back. I cheered as if my life depended on it, because maybe it did. "Do my eyes deceive me?" Mick said from the stage. He had his hand over his brow, shading the spotlight from his eyes. He was looking right at me. Or is that my dream woman right there in the front?
Sub Rosa, November 1st, 1961. Evelyn Hugo and Celia St. James, slumber parties. How close is too close? Girl next door, Celia St. James, with her Oscar win and her trail of hits, has been a longtime friend of honey blonde sexpot Evelyn Hugo. But lately, we're starting to wonder if these two aren't up to something. Insiders are saying the two are quite a pair of thespians. Sure, plenty of girlfriends go shopping together and share a drink or two. But Celia's car is parked outside Evelyn's home, the one she used to share with none other than Mr. Don Adler every night. All night. So what's happening behind those walls? Whatever it is, it certainly doesn't sound like it's on the straight and narrow.
I'm going out on a date with Mick Riva. Like hell you are. When Celia was angry, her chest and her cheeks flushed. This time they'd grown red faster than I'd ever seen. We were in the outdoor kitchen of her weekend home in Palm Springs. She was grilling us burgers for dinner. Ever since the article came out, I'd refused to be seen with her in Los Angeles. The Rags didn't yet know about her place in Palm Springs, so we would spend weekends there together and our weeks in L.A. apart. Celia went along with the plan like a put-upon spouse, agreeing to whatever I wanted because it was easier than fighting with me. But now, with the suggestion of going on a date, I'd gone too far. I knew I'd gone too far. That was the point, sort of. "You need to listen to me," I said. "You need to listen to me!" She slammed the lid of the grill shut and gestured to me with a pair of silver tongs. "I'll go along with any of your little tricks that you want, but I'm not getting on board with either of us dating." "We don't have a choice." "We have plenty of choices." "Not if you want to keep your job. Not if you want to keep this house. Not if you want to keep any of our friends. Not to mention that the police could come after us." "You are being paranoid." "I'm not, Celia. And that's what's scary. But I'm telling you, they know. One article in one tiny paper thinks they know. That's not the same thing." "You're right. This is still early enough that we can stop it. Or it will go away on its own. Celia, you have two movies coming out next year. and my movie is all anyone is talking about around town.
Exactly. Like Harry always says, that means we can do whatever we want.
No, that means we have a lot to lose. Celia, angry, picked up my pack of cigarettes and lit one.
So that's what you want to do? You want to spend every second of our lives trying to hide what we really do, who we really are?
It's what everyone in town is doing every day.
Well, I don't want to.
Well, then, you shouldn't have become famous.
Celia stared at me as she puffed away at her cigarette. The pink of her lipstick stained the filter.
You're a pessimist, Evelyn, to your very core.
What would you like to do, Celia? Maybe I should call over to Sub Rosa myself? Call the FBI directly? I can give them a quote.
Yep, Celia St. James and I are deviants.
We aren't deviants. I know that, Celia, and you know that, but no one else knows that.
But maybe they would if they tried.
They aren't going to try. Do you get that? No one wants to understand people like us.
But they should.
There are lots of things we all should do, sweetheart, but it doesn't work that way.
I hate this conversation. You're making me feel awful.
I know, and I'm sorry. But the fact that it's awful doesn't mean it's not true. If you want to keep your job, you cannot allow people to believe that you and I are more than friends.
And if I don't want to keep my job?
You do want to.
No, you want to, and you're pinning it on me.
Of course I want to.
I'd give it all up, you know. All of it. The money and the jobs and the fame. I'd give it all up just to be with you. Just to be normal with you.
You have no idea what you're saying, Celia. I'm sorry, but you don't.
What's really going on here is that you're not willing to give it up for me.
No. What's going on here is that you're a dilettante who thinks if this acting thing doesn't work out, you can go back to Savannah and live off your parents.
Who are you to talk to me about money? You've got bags of it.
Yeah, I do. Because I worked my ass off and was married to an asshole who knocked me around. And I did that so I could be famous. So I could live the life we're living. And if you think I'm not going to protect that, you've lost your mind.
At least you're admitting this is about you.
I shook my head and pinched the bridge of my nose.
Celia, listen to me.
Do you love that Oscar? The very thing you keep on your nightstand and touch before you go to sleep?
Don't. People are saying, given how early you won it, you're the kind of actress who could win multiple times.
I want that for you. Don't you want that?
Of course I do.
And you're going to let them take that away just because you met me?
Well, no, but
listen to me, Celia. I love you. And I can't let you throw away everything you have built and all your incredible talent by taking a stand when no one will stand with us.
But if we don't try, no one is going to back us, Celia.
I know how it feels to be shut out of this town. I'm just finally making my way back in. I know you're probably picturing some world where we go up against Goliath and win, but that's not going to happen. We'd tell the truth about our lives, and they'd bury us. We could end up in prison or in a mental hospital. Do you get that? We could be committed. It's not that far-fetched. It happens.
Certainly you can count on the fact that no one would return our calls, not even Harry.
Of course Harry would. Harry's one of us.
Which is precisely why he could never be caught talking to us again.
Don't you get it?
The danger is even higher for him. There are actually men out there who would want to kill him if they knew.
That's the world we live in.
Anyone who touched us would be examined.
Harry wouldn't be able to withstand it. I could never put him in that position. To lose everything he's worked for? To quite literally risk his life? No.
No, we'd be alone, two pariahs.
But we'd have each other. And that's enough for me.
She was crying now, the tears streaking down her face and carrying her mascara with them. I put my arms around her and wiped her cheek with my thumb. I love you so much, sweetheart, so, so much. And it's in part because of things like that. You're an idealist and a romantic, and you have a beautiful soul, and I wish the world was ready to be the way you see it. I wish that the rest of the people on Earth with us were capable of living up to your expectations, but they aren't. The world is ugly, and no one wants to give anyone the benefit of the doubt about anything. When we lose our work and our reputations, when we lose our friends and eventually what money we have, we will be destitute. I've lived that life before, and I cannot let it happen to you. I will do whatever I can to prevent you from living that way. Do you hear me? I love you too much to let you live only for me. She heaved into my body, her tears growing inside her. For a moment I thought she might flood the backyard. I love you, she said. I love you too, I whispered into her ear. I love you more than anything else in the entire world. It's not wrong, Celia said. It shouldn't be wrong to love you. How can it be wrong? It's not wrong, sweetheart, it's not, I said. They are wrong. She nodded into my shoulder and held me tighter. I rubbed her back. I smelled her hair. It's just that there's not much we can do about it, I said. When she calmed down, she pulled away from me and opened the grill again. She did not look at me as she flipped the burgers. So what is your plan, she said. I'm going to get Mick Riva to elope with me. Her eyes, which already looked sore from crying, started to bloom again. She wiped a tear away, keeping her eyes on the grill. What does that mean for us? She said. I stood behind her and put my arms around her. It doesn't mean what you think it means. I'm going to see if I can get him to elope with me, and then I'm going to have it annulled.
And you think that means they'll stop watching you?
No, I know it means they will only watch me more. But they will be looking for other things. They will call me a tart or a fool. They will say I have terrible taste in men. They will say I'm a bad wife. I am too impulsive. But if they want to do any of that, they'll have to stop saying I'm with you. It won't fit their story anymore. I get it, she said, grabbing a plate and taking the burgers off the grill. Okay, good, I said. You'll do whatever you have to do, but this is the last I want to hear about it, and I want it to be over and done with as soon as possible. Okay. And when it's over, I want us to move in together.
Celia, we can't do that.
You said this would be so effective that no one would ever mention us. The thing is, I wanted us to move in together, too. I wanted it very much. Okay, I said. When it's over, we'll talk about moving in together. Okay, she said, then we have a deal. I put my hand out to shake hers, but she waved it away. She didn't want to shake on something that sad, that vulgar. And if it doesn't work with Mick Riva, she asked. It's gonna work. Celia finally looked up at me. She was half smiling. You think you're so gorgeous that no one can possibly resist your charms?
Yes, actually.
All right, she said, rising slightly on her toes to kiss me. I suppose that's true. I wore a cream-colored cocktail dress with heavy gold beading and a plunging neckline. I pulled my long blonde hair into a high ponytail. I wore diamond earrings. I glowed. The first thing you need to do to get a man to elope with you is to challenge him to go to Las Vegas. You do this by being out in an L.A. club and having a few drinks together. You ignore the impulse to roll your eyes at how eager he is to have his picture taken with you. You recognize that everyone is playing everyone else. It's only fair that he's playing you at the same time as you're playing him. You reconcile these facts by realizing that what you both want from each other is complementary. You want a scandal. He wants the world to know he screwed you. The two things are one and the same. You consider laying it out for him, explaining what you want, explaining what you're willing to give him. But you've been famous long enough to know that you never tell anyone anything more than you have to. So instead of saying, "I'd like us to make tomorrow's papers," you say, "Mick, have you ever been to Vegas?" When he scoffs as if he can't believe you're asking him if he's ever been to Vegas, you know this will be easier than you thought. "Sometimes I just get in the mood to roll dice, you know," you say. Sexual implications are better when they are gradual, when they snowball over time. "You want to roll dice, baby?" he says, and you nod. "But it's probably too late," you say, "and we're already here, and here's okay, I suppose. I'm having a fine time." "My guys can call a plane and have us there like that," he snaps his fingers. "No," you say, "that's too much." "Not for you," he says. "Nothing is too much for you." You know what he really means is, "Nothing is too much for me." "You could really do that," you say. An hour and a half later, you're on a plane. You have a few drinks, you sit in his lap, you let his hand wander and you slap it back. He has to ache for you and believe there is only one way to have you. If he doesn't want you enough, if he believes he can get you another way, it's all over, you've lost. When the plane lands and he asks if the two of you should book a room at the Sands, you must demur. You must be shocked. You must tell him, in a voice that makes it clear you assumed he already knew, that you don't have sex outside of marriage. You must seem both steadfast and heartbroken about this. He must think, "She wants me, and the only way we can make it happen is to get married." For a moment, you consider the idea that what you're doing is unkind. But then you remember that this man is going to bed you and then divorce you once he's gotten what he wants, so no one is a saint here. You're going to give him what he's asking for, so it's a fair trade. You go to the craps table and play a couple of rounds. You keep losing at first, as does he, and you worry that this is sobering both of you. You know the key to impulsivity is believing you are invincible. No one goes around throwing caution to the wind unless the wind is blowing their way. You drink champagne because it makes everything seem celebratory. It makes tonight seem like an event. When people recognize the two of you, you happily agree to get your picture taken with them. Every time it happens, you hang on to him. You are telling him in no small way, "This is what it could be like if I belong to you." You hit a winning streak at the roulette table. You cheer so ebulliently that you jump up and down. You do this because you know where his eyes are going to go. You let him catch you catching him. You let him put his hand on your ass as the wheel spins again. This time when you win, you push your ass against him. You let him lean into you and say, "Do you want to get out of here?" You say, "I don't think it's a good idea. I don't trust myself with you." You cannot bring up marriage first. You already said the word earlier. You have to wait for him to say it. He said it in the papers. He will say it again, but you have to wait. You cannot rush it. He has one more drink. The two of you win three more times. You let his hand graze your upper thigh, and then you push it away. It is 2 a.m., and you are tired. You miss the love of your life. You want to go home. You would rather be with her in bed, hearing the light buzz of her snoring, watching her sleep, than be here. There is nothing about here that you love, except what being here will afford you. You imagine a world where the two of you can go out to dinner together on a Saturday night, and no one thinks twice about it. It makes you want to cry, the simplicity of it. the smallness of it. You have worked so hard for a life so grand. And now all you want are the smallest freedoms, the daily peace of loving plainly. Tonight feels like both a small and a high price to pay for that life.
Baby, I can't take it, he says. I have to be with you. I have to see you. I have to love you.
This is your chance. You have a fish on the line, and you have to gently reel him in.
Oh, Mick, you say, we can't. We can't.
I think I love you, baby, he says. There are tears in his eyes, and you realize he's probably more complex than you have given him credit for.
You're more complex than he's given you credit for, too.
Do you mean it? You ask him, as if you desperately hope it's true.
I think I do, baby, I do. I love everything about you. We only just met, but I feel like I can't live without you.
What he means is that he thinks he can't live without screwing you, and that you believe.
Oh, Mick, you say, and then you say nothing more.
Silence is your best friend. He nuzzles your neck. It's sloppy, and it feels akin to meeting a Newfoundland, but you pretend you love it. You two are in the bright lights of a Vegas casino. People can see you. You have to pretend that you do not notice them. That way tomorrow, when they talk to the papers, they will say that the two of you were carrying on like a couple of teenagers. You hope that Celia doesn't pick up a single rag with your face on it. You think she's smart enough not to. You think she knows how to protect herself, but you can't be sure. The first thing you're going to do when you get home, when this is all over, is to make sure she knows how important she is, how beautiful she is, how much you feel your life would be over if she were not in it.
Let's get married, baby, he says into your ear.
There it is. For you to grab. But you can't look too eager.
Mick, are you crazy?
You make me this crazy.
We can't get married, you say, and when he doesn't say anything back for a second, you worry that you've pushed slightly too far.
Or can we, you ask. I mean, I suppose we could.
Of course we can, he says. We're on top of the world. We can do anything we want.
You throw your arms around him and you press against him to let him know how excited, how surprised you are by this idea. And to remind him what he's doing it for. You know your value to him. It would be silly to waste an opportunity to remind him. He picks you up and sweeps you away. You whoop and holler so everyone looks. Tomorrow they will tell the papers he carried you off. It's memorable. They will remember it. 40 minutes later, the two of you are drunk and standing in front of each other at an altar. He promises to love you forever. You promise to obey. He carries you over the threshold of the nicest room at the Tropicana. You giggle with fake surprise when he throws you onto the bed. And now, here comes the second most important part. You cannot be a good lay. You must disappoint. If he likes it, he'll want to do it again. And you can't do that. You can't do this more than once. It will break your heart. When he tries to rip your dress off, you have to say, "Stop, Mick. Christ, get a hold of yourself." After you take the dress off slowly, you have to let him look at your breasts for as long as he wants to. He has to see every inch of them. He's been waiting for so long to finally see the ending of that shot in Boutantrain. You have to remove all mystery, all intrigue. You make him play with your breast so long he gets bored, and then you open your legs. You lie there stiff as a board underneath him. And here is the one part of this you can't quite come to terms with, but you can't quite avoid either. He won't use a condom. And even though women you know have gotten hold of birth control pills, you don't have them because you had no need for them until a few days ago when you hatched this plan. You cross your fingers behind your back. You close your eyes. You feel his heavy body fall on top of you, and you know that he is done. You want to cry, because you remember what sex used to mean to you before. Before you realized how good it could feel, before you discovered what you liked. But you push it out of your mind, you push it all out of your mind. Mick doesn't say anything afterward, and you don't either. You fall asleep, having put on his undershirt in the dark because you didn't want to sleep naked. In the morning, when the sun shines through the windows and burns your eyes, you put your arm over your face. Your head is pounding. Your heart is hurting. But you're almost at the finish line. You catch his eye. He smiles. He grabs you. You push him off and say, "I don't like to have sex in the morning." "What does that mean?" he says. You shrug. "I'm sorry." He says, "Come on, baby," and lies on top of you. You're not sure he'd listen if you said no one more time, and you're not sure you want to find out the answer. You're not sure you could bear it. "Okay, fine, if you have to," you say. And when he lifts himself off you and looks you in the eye, you realize it has accomplished what you had hoped. You have taken all the fun out of it for him. He shakes his head. He gets out of bed. He says, "You know, you're nothing like I imagined." It doesn't matter how gorgeous a woman is to a man like Mick Riva. She's always less attractive after he's had sex with her. You know this. You allow it to happen. You do not fix your hair. You pick at the mascara flakes on your face. You watch Mick step into the bathroom. You hear him turn on the shower. When he comes out, he sits down next to you on the bed. He is clean. You have not bathed. He smells like soap. You smell like booze. He is sitting up. You are lying down. This, too, is a calculation. He has to feel like the power is all his. "Honey, I had a great time," he says. You nod. "But we were so drunk." He speaks as if he's talking to a child. "Both of us. We had no idea what we were doing." "I know," you say. "It was a crazy thing to do." "I'm not a good guy, baby," he says. "You don't deserve a guy like me. I don't deserve a girl like you." It's just so unoriginal and laughably transparent, feeding you the same line he fed the papers about his last wife. "What are you saying?" you ask. You put a little spin into it. You make it sound like you might start crying. You have to do this because it is what most women would do. And you have to appear to him the way he sees most women. You have to appear to have been outsmarted. "I think we should call our people, baby. I think we should get an annulment." "But Mick," he cuts you off, and it makes you mad because you really did have more to say. "It's better this way, honey. I'm afraid I can't take no for an answer." You wonder what it must be like to be a man. To be so confident that the final say is yours. When he gets up off the bed and grabs his jacket, you realize there's an element of this that you hadn't accounted for. He likes to reject. He likes to condescend. When he was calculating his moves last night, he was thinking of this moment, too. This moment where he gets to leave you. So you do something you haven't rehearsed in your mind. When he gets to the door and turns to you and says, "I'm sorry it didn't work out between us, baby, but I wish you all the best," you pick up the phone on the side of the bed and throw it at him. You do it because you know he'll like it, because he's given you everything you came for. You should give him everything he came for. He ducks and frowns at you, as if you're a small deer he has to leave in the forest. You start crying, and then he's gone. And you stop. And you think. If only they gave out Oscars for this shit.
Photo moment. December 4th, 1961. Riva and Hugo lose their minds. Heard of a quickie wedding? How about a quickie marriage? Well, this one takes the cake. Bombshell Evelyn Hugo was spotted in the lap of none other than her biggest fan, Mick Riva, last Friday night in the heart of Las Vegas. Card players and dice guys alike were treated to quite a show by the two of them. Canoodling, necking, and drinking up a storm from the craps table right out the door and down the street to a chapel. That's right. Evelyn Hugo and Mick Riva got married. And to make matters even crazier, they promptly filed for an annulment. The booze seemed to have gotten to their heads, and in the morning, clearer heads prevailed. With a string of failed marriages between the two of them, what's one more? Sub Rosa, December 12th, 1961. Evelyn Hugo's heartbreak. Don't believe what you hear about Evelyn and Mick's drunken escapades. Mick may get a little too eager with the drink, but those in the know say Evelyn was in full control that night and desperately wanted to get married. Poor Evelyn's had such a hard time finding love after Don left her. It's no wonder she would throw herself into the arms of the first handsome man to come along. And we're hearing she's inconsolable since he left her. It seems like Evelyn was no more than a night of fun to Mick, but she really thought they had a future together. We just hope Evelyn can get it right one of these days.
For 2 months, I was living in near bliss. Celia and I never talked about Mick, because we didn't have to. Instead, we could go wherever we wanted, do whatever we wanted. Celia bought a second car, a boring brown sedan, and left it parked in my driveway every night without anyone asking questions. We would sleep cradling each other, turning off the light an hour before we wanted to fall asleep, so that we could talk in the darkness. I would trace the lines of her palm with my fingertips in the mornings to wake her up. On my birthday, she took me out to the polo lounge. We were hiding in plain sight. Fortunately, painting me as some woman who couldn't keep a husband sold more papers for a longer period of time than outing me. I'm not saying the gossip columnists printed what they knew to be a lie. I'm simply saying they were all too happy to believe the lie I was selling them. And of course, that's the easiest lie to tell, one you know the other person desperately wants to be true. All I had to do was make sure that my romantic scandals felt like a story that would keep making headlines. And as long as I did that, I knew the gossip rags would never look too closely at Celia. And it was all working so goddamn beautifully, until I found out I was pregnant. "You are not," Celia said to me. She was standing in my pool, in a lavender polka-dot bikini and sunglasses. "Yes," I said, "I am." I had just brought her out a glass of iced tea from the kitchen. I was standing right in front of her, looming over her in a blue cover-up and sandals. I'd suspected I was pregnant for 2 weeks. I'd known for sure since the day before, when I went to Burbank and saw a discreet doctor Harry had recommended. I told her then, when she was in the pool and I was holding a glass of iced tea with a slice of lemon in it, because I couldn't hold it in anymore. I am and have always been a great liar, but Celia was sacred to me, and I never wanted to lie to her. I was under no illusions about how much it had cost Celia and me to be together, and that it was going to continue to cost us more. It was like a tax on being happy. The world was going to take 50% of my happiness, but I could keep the other 50%. And that was her, and this life we had. But keeping something like this from her felt wrong, and I couldn't do it. I put my feet into the pool next to her and tried to touch her, tried to comfort her. I expected that the news would upset her, but I did not expect her to hurl the iced tea to the other side of the pool.